About 2 years ago, I was in a bookstore browsing through the religion aisle. And religion has always fascinated me. I've always felt called since I was a young girl, you know, to seek out spiritual truth or meaning in my life, make sense of things. And, you know, my path, or should I say paths, you know, in and out of religious and spiritual practices and traditions has not been a straight and narrow one, but very wide and winding and full of bumps and beautiful gifts. But in that bookstore, my path took another turn as I looked and saw a book on the Catholic shelf called Building a Bridge: How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. And the book, written by Father James Martin, grabbed my attention in a way that very few things Catholic had in a very long time. So I opened it, and on the first page was a passage from the Book of Psalms, number 139. For it was you who formed my inward parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, that I know very well. My eyes welled with tears, and I actually sat on the floor of the bookstore holding this book. It had been ages since I'd picked up anything having to do with Catholicism or a Bible, and it had been even longer since I'd done so by choice and actually felt at peace upon reading what was in front of me. Something about that psalm shook me inside and shifted my consciousness, my sense of my own faith. A few months before I found the book, I had attended Easter Vigil Mass with my grandmother for the first time in years, and something had shifted in me then as well. I think maybe it was the chant, you know, the beautiful singing of the Kyrie and the Gloria from the choir lofts, or the familiarity of being with my grandma in my childhood church, but something about it caused me to feel such a great sense of uneasiness. And it was an uneasiness that I think was not born of discomfort, but really of comfort at the strangeness of how comfortable I was in a place that had caused at times like such great pain. And I think I stifled that feeling until I opened Father Martin's book, and I could no longer ignore a yearning to return, you know, and a yearning that existed alongside such a fear to return as well. His book caused me to recall my childhood in the church. You know, for the first time in my life, I came to realize that things I thought of as secular concerns always were and forever will be deeply Catholic. My most formative fundamental beliefs surrounding justice, kindness, compassion, love, and liberation were formed in Catholic school against the backdrop of scriptures, of the Mass, and the lives of the saints. And that's what I cling to, those formative values, those ideas that are not just good things that we come up with, but divinely ordained ideas that we should be moving towards always. And that is what I fight every toxic and damaging act of rejection with. The radical action and love that our scriptures and our Christ repeatedly call for when we humans get it wrong. So I don't have it all together, but what I do know is that when I made my way back to a church and heard the choir and felt the organ shake the walls, I felt I'd come home, albeit with a new understanding of what home is and means for me. I have learned over the years that home can be found in an endless number of places and feelings, and that the arms of a woman is one of them, and so is the embrace of our God. I had to realize that it's all holy, it's all sacred, and that all of this anger and this rage that we hold about the state of our church is worthy and necessary. I am queer and Catholic, and neither queerness nor Catholicism is confined to a pride parade or a pew. Welcome to Tabardin, everybody. Thank you.
That story was by Vine and Fig community member Jordan Kennedy. Welcome to Tabard In, y'all, a weekly podcast about the stories we tell and the events we discuss while on pilgrimage as queer Catholics worthy of love at home and at church. I'm Jacob Flores, baptized this past Easter, dog dad, Ariana Grande stan, and lover of Anglican high church choirs. Who are you?
I'm his fiance, Pat Gothman. I pursued celibacy for 10 years until I realized that you can't choose celibacy merely out of fear and loathing, and so I went and found a hot co-host and convinced him to marry me.
Oh.
So, hot co-host, what have we got on the podcast today?
Today we've got something pretty special and a little different. We interviewed James Allison. He is a British-born Catholic priest and theologian, one of the few openly gay priests out there. He has spent years trying to tell the truth about the dignity of queer lives in the church. And what seemed so marginal when he first started talking about this over 30 years ago, now increasingly seems mainstream.
Yeah, so he is an incredible priest. He has been working on acceptance for queer folks in the church for a really long time, and he was even laicized by the Vatican for his work until Pope Francis called him recently and told him to get back to work. So we talked to him about what it is like to have the Pope call his cell phone, which is a crazy experience. I can't imagine that ever happening. I'm a good millennial and I never answer the phone, so I'm sure he would never get through anyway. What he thinks Pope Francis really wants for queer people within the church, why he thinks that the gay issue is much more of an emotional issue for the church to deal with rather than a theological one, what unique spiritual gifts he thinks queer Catholics have, and a whole lot more.
So what you're saying is you should answer those unknown numbers.
Those unknown numbers just might be the Pope, because he told us that it was a blocked call and it was the Pope on the other end.
Yikes. And as always, we'll end the episode by toasting our biggest inspirations this week. You can find us at Vine and Fig Co. on social media and at vineandfig.co on the web.
James spoke with us from his home in Madrid, so there's a couple moments where we stepped on each other due to the lag, and we do apologize for that. But without further ado, here is James Allison. Alrighty, well, James Allison, welcome to Tabard In. So you are a theologian, a Catholic priest, an out gay man, and an advocate for full LGBTQ inclusion in the church, aspects which both to many outside the church and inside the Catholic Church probably appear contradictory. So what do you feel like is kind of holding you together?
Wow. Well, I guess it's because what I've understood and what I try to explain and teach is that if we actually go to what is basic in Christianity about Jesus, why he came, what he did for us, what he does for us, why he gave us the Holy Spirit, it's kind of so obviously gay-friendly that, as it were, the mystery is why people are still fooled by all the clerical fuss budgetary concerning matters gay, why they find it so difficult to see that as all the deeper melodies of the Catholic faith are very obviously gay friendly. So yeah, that's what keeps me going. It keeps me going, the sense that, hey, this is all about people like us. It's obvious that we're on the inside of this. Now we've just got to try and make sure that the icing matches the cake.
So do you think the clericalism is what gets in the way of people fully understanding and kind of allowing the
mostly
church?
Yeah, I mean, what I observed over the years of dealing with this is how incredibly quickly the Catholic faithful, particularly in Catholic majority countries, move on this issue. The moment it becomes clear that being gay is just something that some people are, people say, okay, yep, in that case, obviously they've got to be who they are to the best of their possible capacity. And that's that. So the speed with which, for instance, in Spain, in Argentina, in Brazil, Mexico, the laity understood the ordinariness of gay people and how they're basically part of all our families. And of course, naturally, if you love family, you want your gay son, nephew, brother, uncle, or whatever, you want his or her significant other to be part of your family. And that's been the way it's worked. So that if you look at opinion polls in the United States and other countries, typically the Catholic faithful, when polled, are above average in their, and they're above the average of the population in terms of their gay friendliness.
What do you think it says about the church that the faithful, the regular folks in the pews are kind of leading on this issue?
I guess because most of them are straight, and therefore they're not tortured by the issue in the way that so many of the clergy are, given that the majority, certainly of the higher clergy, is gay. And the majority of the higher clergy who are gay are dealing with, or sometimes failing to deal with, issues of their own honesty surrounding this and get caught in a trap. So it's very, very difficult. It's very difficult to be out as a gay priest, and much more as a gay bishop, even though most bishops are gay. It's people who are able to be honest about it, who are able to talk about these things, and they're people who are able to talk about things, are able to deal with them relationally rather than intellectually.
What was it like when you came out publicly as a gay priest?
Well, I'm honestly not sure what's meant by that, because, I mean, I was out throughout the time, I mean, from the time I entered into religious life, and so at the time of my ordination, I mean, I was out to my family, I was out to my friends, I was out within the congregation. I mean, I was working in Brazil with AIDS, mm-hmm. people with AIDS, so I was even outed by the Archbishop to my pleasure, simply by him telling other people that I was working with people with AIDS, whereas my own community had asked me not to let people know that I was gay on the grounds that it might cause scandal. Where in fact, the Archbishop outed me as working with people with AIDS, which at that time meant if you worked with people with AIDS, then you were clearly gay. Mm-hmm. And of course, the so-called simple faithful who were thought by my superiors likely to be scandalized were immediately delighted and came to me and said, "Hey, James, come and give us a talk about this, that, the other." And, you know, it's always the reverse. The frightened closeted are always frightened as to how much worse it's going to go than it does in fact go with regards to the simple faithful.
So you were out.
Oh yeah, no, I've been out, and had endless battles, precisely because, you know, if you attempt to speak with something approaching honesty and with something approaching a desire for justice in this area, you really, really rattle the ship. I mean, what's the word in Spanish? They say meter el dedo en la llaga. You're putting your finger in the wound. Because you're touching the issue about which no one dares to talk. So, I mean, so the question is not when I was honest, but what I learned, mm-hmm. it was only rather later, like at the age of 35, when I'd already been 6 years a priest, that I actually finally accepted myself completely as realizing that, no, I'm not a screwed up straight person. And my love is not distorted and sick love, but the real thing. So I guess it's from about 6 years into my priesthood that I was genuinely in good conscience, if you like.
Beautiful.
About being a gay man.
Mm-hmm. When you were laicized, where did you find the most support? Where were the most
The formal laicization didn't happen until 3-4 years ago, 2015. Mm-hmm. And one of the things about the document is that it actually says that you shouldn't tell people, you shouldn't give scandal by telling people about mm-hmm. it. The document is specifically addressed to the archdiocese that did the laicizing. But so I only told people on a need-to-know basis because I didn't want to cause scandal. I mean, one of the easy things to do would have been to make a fuss about it and go to the press and all that and present myself as a victim and all that, which seems to me to be exactly the wrong thing to do. So I only told people whom I didn't want to get into trouble, given that they'd invited me to preside, for instance, in their parish. So I said, "Listen, are you sure? You really sure you want to go ahead with this?" And that was when, in the case of one of them, and these are often Jesuits, wise old Jesuits, who said, "Ah, pay no attention to that. It would be far, far more scandalous were you to tell people about this and obey it than for you to carry on as normal." So yeah, no, but I wasn't supported by many people because not many people knew. I kept the question quiet precisely so as not to cause scandal and not to get into one of those, you know, victimary.
So it was a bit of its own closet that you were put in by the Vatican, but this time about your own status as a priest.
You know, I'm sure that they just think of it as a legal matter and that's it. They're not concerned with anybody's real life. But so that lasted for less than 18 months because the moment my former novice master, who was a bishop at the moment, I chatted with him about it. He said, this is ridiculous. And he offered to seek a private audience with the Holy Father. So from that moment, and he said to me, really, you just should treat this as nonsense. I mean, pay no attention to it.
So recently you wrote about the time that Pope Francis called you in and restored you to full ministry as a priest, and he had some incredibly moving words for you. Can you share a little bit about what he said for any of our listeners who may not have read the article? Where you outlined some of that?
Yeah, well, and of course it's better in Spanish, so I'll say it both in Spanish and in English.
Great.
So the phone rings with one of those hidden number things, so I don't know who's calling. And I answer it, and the voice says, "Soy el Papa Francisco." I'm Pope Francis. And so I then say in Spanish, "En serio? Seriously?" And he says, "No, en broma, hijo. No, just kidding, son." Which is very good. It suggests to me that he's had a similar reaction to others when he's rung them up. But then he said, when he was clear that it was me, and he'd been looking at my letter, because my former novice master, now a bishop, had taken a letter from me to him in which I'd explained that I'd received this letter in Latin, forcibly laicizing me, and it was incompatible with his own stated views on the kind of apostolate that I'd been doing. And so I said, I honestly don't know which one of these two is genuinely you and therefore which I should obey. And I'm going for your public statements rather than the Latin document version, but I expose my conscience to you. So you tell me which you it was.
Sure.
Who's been talking, which is something I learned from the Jesuits. The Jesuits have a thing called exposure of conscience, where if there's something you genuinely don't know what to do, you expose your conscience to the superior. So that would have been something that I know he's familiar with. And so he looked at the letter, and it was clearly him, because he had the letter, which was private. And he said, "Mire, yo quiero que camines con plena libertad interior. I want you to walk with full interior freedom. Siguiendo en el Espíritu de Jesús, following in the, maybe he said caminando en el Espíritu de Jesús, walking in the Spirit of Jesus. Y te doy el poder de las llaves, and I give you the power of the keys. ¿Me entiendes? Do you understand me? Te doy el poder de las llaves." So he repeated that twice, just as, because he was clearly making a point. And so, of course, I said that I understood, which I didn't really, because if the Pope says, "Do you understand?" I will still
reply. Right, exactly.
So we went on to talk about other things. You know, what at the very least, what I deduced from that was that it meant that he was treating me as a priest and that he was giving me what they called universal jurisdiction to hear confessions. And that's because, I don't know whether this is commonly known, but if you're ordained a priest, the ability to preside at Mass comes with ordination. But the ability to absolve in confession is a juridical matter for which you need jurisdiction, theoretically, from the bishop. Or if you're a member of a religious order, from the religious superior. So he was effectively saying, "Listen, I'm giving that to you wherever you are, so you don't need to worry about the fact that you don't have either a bishop or a religious superior."
Yeah, so he knew you were kind of in a Neverland, an in-between area, and he stepped in to
provide what was lacking there. In limbo, as it were. Yeah. So curiously, he didn't do, and it's worth saying that he didn't do what I'd asked him to do, which was to regularize my situation. Which would have been to say, "I will now find you someone to whom you can belong and we'll set up the whole canonical system." He said, "Okay, I can see that." Effectively, he was saying, "Okay, you're in limbo. This is how you carry on doing what you're doing. Be free, be an adult, carry on doing what you're doing. I trust your discretion." Which is very remarkable.
Yeah, that is. And I'm curious, even just on a basic level, like, yeah, I know you were translating for, or, you know, saying telling us what he spoke in Spanish, but what does he sound like on the phone? Like, how does he talk? I think we see this very almost a magisterial version of him when we see him on TV, and he just seems very far away, but you got this very intimate version of him. What was that like?
Oh, curiously, he was exactly like what I had assumed he would be from TV, because I don't see him as a distant magisterial figure. That I would see someone like Ratzinger as a distant magisterial figure. But no, he was, I suppose it's because I understand Spanish quite well. So I'm aware of him having had conversations with people, and I'm aware of how jovial he is in Spanish. So he was jovial. I mean, he's an elderly Argentinian gentleman, and he's jovial. And he was very good humored throughout. But he was, you know, he was quite careful. He looked through my letter and looked at various points and saw people we had in common and made jokes. But so, yes, I was, in a sense, I was delighted to see that he is exactly what he sees, what you see, what I had picked up. I was talking to a very jovial, elderly Argentinian Jesuit superior who just happened to be Pope. and yes, he was in good humor, and he was dealing with something in a very straightforward and deliberate manner. I didn't understand immediately how straightforward and deliberately. In other words, it took time for me to kick in that this is what the First Vatican Council meant by an immediate act of the universal ordinary. In other words, it's escapes canon law.
So having spoken with the Pope on the phone, what do you think he honestly wants for queer Catholics and for the Church when it comes to LGBTQ issues?
Well, first of all, I think that he is, and this is simply what I got in the very few minutes we talked, I think that he's completely aware of quite how problematic the issue is and has been for us living the faith. The sense, I mean, more than that, he certainly didn't say to me, other than that he was aware, and he had been aware since his time in Buenos Aires about this. The sense I'm getting from how he copes with me, with Juan Carlos Cruz, with Jim Martin, how he's coped with the Martel book, is basically he's very relaxed about this. And he's saying effectively, and I hope I'm not putting words in his mouth, listen, this is a complicated matter which raises a great deal of tension and hysteria amongst particularly closeted and rigid Catholics. So I can hold the doors open for you to go and do what you need to do. So don't ask my permission. Just get on with things. Create reality on the ground while I'm keeping the doors open. So that's the impression I get from him. Why I think that with some history is that I'm aware that in the first synod meeting, so the 2014 synod meeting, there was an attempt by the organizers, I think with his backing, to get the gay thing dealt with positively. And there was a huge row in the Synod Hall, which of course was kept from the public, by several of the most homophobic and reactionary bishops and cardinals. Really, really frighteningly violent. And I think that he realized, and other people realize, is as we've seen in all the other denominations that have dealt with this issue, it's not something that can be talked about rationally for certain people. It's too much of a trigger. So my sense is that since then, he has thought, okay, this is something that's got to be dealt with by slippage. In other words, it's if you do it face on, then you give the allergics the chance to bloviate. So it's got to be done by slippage, which means that as people get used to it being normal to talk about this, so the weight of the old-fashioned homophobic closeted guys becomes less. And so you start getting bishops and priests who are able to say in public the kind of things that bishops and priests have now started saying in public all over the place, which is, yes, we've got to look at this. Yes, we need to have gay-friendly pastoral set up in our diocese. No, we won't only accept courage as being the one single model of right. Catholic pastoral. Yes, it's perfectly obvious that we're heading towards understanding LGBT married people. And I think that throughout the world, I think that curiously the most difficult place for that is the U.S.
Yeah, there's some quite vocal backlash, isn't there?
Well, and I think that's because the terrible, terrible policy which was started by John Paul, or that John Paul was either fooled into doing, but certainly went along with, of appointing culture war bishops in the basically running the first along the first things model of an alliance between right-wing Catholics and evangelicals to make a Republican Party friendly, moralistic right. Catholicism, as opposed to a Democratic Party friendly social Catholicism, and that was quite clearly what the program was. And you know, Chaput and Cardinal George and others were the poster boys for that. And boy, have they run the roost for the last 30 years. So the result is that your bishop's conference is engaged in all sorts of horrendous, you know, legal cases to try and allow themselves to discriminate against people, where more and more throughout the world, bishops are realizing that actually that is the death of the church, being locked into the right to discriminate against gay and lesbian people, especially given that most of the bishops are themselves gay and lesbian people. Well, not lesbian. So I think there is a big shift going on, but I think that it's got a much tougher time coming in the US.
Sure, absolutely. So I'd like to ask you a few questions about theology, as you're a theologian, if that's all right. So the Catholic Church often says that the biggest reason a same-sex couple cannot get married is because they cannot naturally conceive children together, and that being open to children is an essential part of marriage. So why are you not convinced by that?
Well, because I think that the key question in marriage, as I understand it, is not the procreation issue, but the until death issue. Remember the principal image we have of marriage, according to St. Paul, is Jesus giving himself out of love up till death for his spouse, the church. So that's, if you like, that's the reality. And what we call marriage is supposed to be the sign of that. So the central difference, if you like, between simple secular marriage and baptized marriage, which is what, after all, I mean, Christianity, it took a long time before marriage was recognized as a sacrament within Christianity. And when it was recognized as a sacrament, it was recognized because it was baptism that turned the secular reality into a Christian one. And the whole point of the baptism is the dying with Christ in advance so as to be able to live his life forever. In other words, it's the up to death part that's key. Now, it doesn't seem to me that there is any reason at all why the gender of a couple matters in that. It's perfectly true that straight people who are incapable of children can be married precisely because they can make a promise to love, honor, worship, and obey, or whatever the language in the marriage rite is, each other, up till death, until death do us part, is the famous phrase. So that's what seems to me to be key in marriage. Now, it's interesting that the American right-wing attackers of gay marriage said, but that's just about friendship, not about marriage. Well, they need to study, what Ratzinger and others have been saying about marriage. No, that's the key thing about marriage, not friendship. They want procreation to be the central feature of marriage, but it's not, never has been. As you know, that would render null a huge variety of marriages in which it turns out that childbearing is impossible. So that's the first point is simply that. Now, the second point is, and I'm simply not sure of what this is to be in the future. Civil marriage is now a reality in many countries in the world between same-sex couples. And it's a reality in the United States. It's a reality even in Texas, where you live. In fact, Texas, I think, was a rather important state in the overcoming of some of the anti-gay legislation. It was, what was it called, Lawrence versus Texas. Was that right? That was one of the key law changes. Okay. For me, what I'm really interested in is discovering, and I don't think we're going to be able to do this quickly, what gay marriage means, what marriage between two people of the same sex means. Civil marriage is perfectly obvious. There are a set of civil realities like visiting rights, inheritance rights, pension rights, etc., etc., that are being the nearest of kin rights, etc., etc., that are resolved by civil marriage. What we don't know, and I think, as I say, this is something that will take time because it will depend on people like you two, is what is it exactly that same-sex couples are bearing witness to? What is the blessing to which you are bearing witness so that we can bless God for blessing us through how God has blessed you, which is what's central to marriage? You know, the marriage ceremony is a ceremony in which the community gathers together to bless God for the blessing that God has given the couple and the blessing that that couple, by witnessing to God's love, is giving to the community. That's the, if you like, that's the nature of the wedding ceremony, liturgically speaking. So I'm not sure that we yet have practical jurisprudence, and by that I mean lived experience, of people for whom getting married was something that they could imagine ever since they were a little kid and started discovering that they were dreaming of Prince Charming rather than Cinderella or whoever, you know. So it's kids who have always been able to imagine themselves getting married and who have started to date at approximately the same time as their straight classmates and so on and so forth. In other words, for whom there has been a certain normality in as far as a minority is ever going to be normality, what it actually means, what is it that they're doing and what is it that they're bearing witness to? So I personally don't want to hurry that process. I don't want people to come up with a definition of what same-sex marriage is, what sort of sacramentality it is, until we have enough evidence from people who are living it and the people who know and love them. So, if you like, it seems to me that exactly what the shape of the sacrament is in the case of same-sex couples, I don't know. And I don't think that any of us knows. And I think that it's going to be your generation of married couples who are going to be able to bear witness to what God's spousal love for us looks like. And that's, of course, something that we're going to all be having to learn, which is why I'm so keen that couples and in dioceses and places where they live keep their evidence, you know, evidence of their wedding ceremonies. What was it that, how did they decide to make their vows? How, what did they do? How did they witness it? All of those things, I think, are hugely important as we come to learn more about the shape of God's love for us as church through the love of our queer.
You speak about not rushing things. And we talk a lot here at Vine and Fig about how real change is slow change, and that you can't change an institution as large as the Catholic Church overnight without the risk of schism and splintering. But what do you think is a change that the church could implement tomorrow that would be a helpful and healthy first step?
Gosh, I never... I think any change issued suddenly like that, as you say, is the kind that produces reaction. I think that little by little, you know, I don't know what is true in the diocese in which you live. Mass is growing of people who are living their lives as gay Catholics in couples or singly or whatever, but honestly and openly. And therefore are beginning to be able to bear witness to what they're about. And that's what it's about. Christianity is essentially a matter of witness. I'm honestly not sure what change would look like, what a single act of change would look like. Of course, ultimately, I hope that it'll be possible for some papal document to mention en passant, of course, we no longer do that as we used to do. You know, we no longer use the Aristotelian deduction concerning gay people as being objectively disordered straight people. It would be nice if they could. It'd be nice if they could mention that en passant in some document. You know, in a sense, the longer the ground rules change, the faster the grounds rules change, the more that parents and families in dioceses simply say, this is unacceptable. We are not going to send our children to your schools if you carry on insisting on teaching them lies. I think that's
kind of at the front lines in the pews.
Where change happens. Yeah, the pews are the front lines in this matter because the people who are working out what it means to have gay family members, gay friends, in all the practical senses, are the people in the pews. It's their kids who are coming up. It's their relatives whom they love who are being denied burial or whatever. Or it's their friends who are being sacked from this or that job in some school or some parish because they got married, whereas everybody had known about it beforehand. But while they weren't formally married, the pastor was able to pretend. And it's when the parishioners just say to the pastor, honey, this really won't do. when you're sacking him merely because he's got married, like we've known his husband has been.
And I think that's something that I, for years. That Pat and I witnessed in Seattle that was really beautiful was a group of gay and lesbians that were always there every Sunday in the front pews and met at coffee hour afterwards. And just as a matter of like a statement, it's saying we're here and we're faithful. And I think that really, for me, it helped me understand that the church, the Catholic Church, isn't what I had assumed before embarking on RCIA. And it was just a beautiful sight to see.
Yeah, and amazing courage and perseverance by people who are just saying, wait a second, I'm not going to let them pretend this isn't my church just because they need to have some faith sort of purity.
If the Pope called for a synod on human sexuality, and he calls you up again and he says, James, I need some advice. Who are we going to invite to participate in this synod on sexuality to make sure that we get it right? Who are you going to tell him? What are you going to tell him that he needs to consider?
Well, I'm not sure whether there will ever be such a synod. Let me say, and I'm pretty certain that I wouldn't get called.
Let's imagine that was a very polite way of inviting you first, and also asking who you want to bring along.
Well, I mean, you know, in English language terms, I just want to say something in a certain sense, the really complicated issues to do with this are not the gay issues. This is something which I want to make clear. Theologically speaking, dealing with the gay issue in the church is not a very difficult one. Psychologically, it is an enormously difficult one because of the density of closeted clergy. In other words, psychologically, it's very difficult to talk about in a clerical group, whereas theologically, actually, it's a pretty straightforward issue. I mean, much more straightforward, for instance, than discussions about divorce and remarriage, which is genuinely a complex theological question to do with sacraments. I think that's the first thing. The really important and difficult and complicated issues in this sphere are to do with straight people, and I think now, interestingly, with trans people. Those which aren't really, I mean, trans people is not to do with sexuality at all, it's to do with being. I think that those are genuinely complicated theological issues that require real experts, scientific experts, and so on. At this stage, with relation to the gay question, the science is pretty clear. This is just something that is. It's not a pathology of any sort at all. It's a non-pathological minority variant in the human condition. Therefore, by definition, it's part of God's created order. So, deal with it. Find out what it's for, if you want to be Aristotelian. So, I don't think you need much expertise with that. I think that just about anybody can get their head around that. Just about every family dealing with having a gay child gets around that. A huge number of kids in middle school are getting their head around that. This is not a very difficult question. So there doesn't need to be much expertise about that. I think that the real expertise comes in the much more difficult issues to do with marriage, divorce, and as I say, trans issues. So, I mean, experts on gay definitely. Sexuality, of course, they would just need to invite some gay couples. They need to have witness the witness of gay parents. They need to have the witness of children of gay parents, because otherwise they spout nonsense, like saying it is inherently violent for same-sex couples to be bringing up children, which we know is nonsense. The science knows it's nonsense. Any number of children would be happy to testify on behalf of their parents that it's nonsense. So, curiously, I don't think that this is a question about experts. I think this is a question about, if you like, relatively easy banality, which we all know. Because, you know, frankly, there is no teaching, properly speaking, about homosexuality in the church. And the reason is quite simple. The only teaching that there has been and that has pretended to be about homosexuality has presumed that the only approach to it is as a deduction from an imagined universal heterosexuality, an intrinsic heterosexuality. So the moment you realize that there is such a thing as gay people and gay people are not in some way disordered straight people, then obviously it's going to become a first-person question, first-person plural question of how we, those of us who live this rather glorious and fun reality of being gay, how we learn what is good for us and for others in our loving. That's something that you no doubt are doing. And you're able to bear witness about that to your friends. I don't think real experts are needed on that.
Well, what I found interesting that you said was that the trans issue within the church would be difficult, but you'd also said it was a matter of being, which I find to be something so simple. Like they just want to be themselves, accepted for who they are. Do you think it's the science and kind of the unknown that is causing it to be a larger issue that we would need experts to come in for?
Oh, I think that, I mean, you know, there are genuine questions about that. I mean, I can't talk about this in the first person, so I really have no expertise, but I do talk to trans people theologically very, very acute trans people about the kind of discussions that they have amongst themselves and for themselves, and their following of the science as it develops to understand what gender dysphoria or gender dysmorphia is, and how they live it and what difference it makes to their understanding of who they are. So I think, yes, I think that the science is in the early stages, as it is in its early stages with all of this. But obviously, the question has been, from church authorities' point of view up till now, it has talked about a them without bothering to consult the them in question. It's been making deductions about them from its supposed starting point, which was what was so catastrophic about the recent Vatican document called Male and Female, He Made Them, or something like that. It said it was about dialogue and then proceeded to lay down the lines in purely a prioristic ways that showed a complete failure to have entered into discussion with the real people who are living this reality and who are very often very sane, well-informed, not at all radical, certainly not hostile people. So, when the church doesn't want to deal with something, it invents a paper tiger. In this case, it's invented a paper tiger called gender theory or something like that. Gender ideology, sorry. Which it then uses to attack everything that questions its own teaching. Well, that's frankly so silly, because the only people it's genuinely important for you to talk about are not the extremists who hold radical views that may hate the church. You want to talk about the real people who are living this as Catholic trans people, of whom there are any number, and who are slowly, gently, and with a good deal of information and support, working these things out.
So Catholicism is, as you know, a very intellectual faith, which it has huge emphasis on reason and philosophy, and we love to write, deep and heady books explaining, all these various aspects of the faith, which is, wonderful for those of us who love to live in our heads, but it's also this tremendously
sacramental and experiential religion. So how do you think we can help the leaders of the church experience the goodness in queer relationships and identities in hopes of kind of helping them get to that place intellectually?
Well, I think you're exactly right. The relational is prior to the intellectual. And I think that that's something that Pope Francis understands. That's something that you clearly understand. It's something that I understand. And that's something which is terrifying for people for whom the intellectual is a form of protection from the relational, because they need to have locked themselves into a box before they dare to relate to people, which is a particularly masculine, often, or particularly male, I should say, and very often, you know, somewhat paranoid form of being. And one, unfortunately, very, very frequent in the higher clergy. It's perfect for the closet. So, I mean, I think that you carry on being fabulous and allow yourself to be fabulous in the company of people who are frightened of it. And you don't do it so as to frighten them, but so as maybe gently to tease them into being able to giggle at themselves. Because that's the solution. It's when people are able to giggle at themselves that we're finally set free. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It's the relational prior to the intellectual. It's things like that group of people that you described in Seattle. It's things like you two going together to discuss things with your pastor or with the vicar general or whatever in a perfectly straightforward way, and clearly not being concerned about your own status of faith or moral life, but about the church and the importance of being able to tell the truth for young people rather than, you know, the fact that you're dealing with a very conflicted, closeted church official saying, okay, that's just a fact of life. We've got to deal with that. We're not going to allow that to run us. We're just going to try and be as honest and straightforward as we are. And with a bit of luck, that will melt people you deal with. But I think that's right. I think it's that kind of witness. It's a non-resentful being sons or daughters of God.
Do you think that we have any spiritual insights or gifts that come with being gay?
Yes. I mean, I think that one of the things that we all are is slightly interstitial people. And we haven't had entirely normal family upbringings. So there's something about being in minority status, which I think is just great. It's what enables the world to have a little spice. We start to look at things in slightly different ways. But also, and I think that this is true now in the life of the church, that we're in a vanguard position. Remember, everyone else is going through a huge crisis of faith about the church because of what's been revealed about it. Well, all our adult lives, it's been hating us. And if we've been able to hold the faith and be confessors of the faith, even when it was doing that, then, if you like, we're the vanguard who are going to be able to tell the truth and help create genuinely holy spaces rather than toxic spaces for the next generation. So I think that you have an enormous amount to offer, and I hope I do as well, precisely through having been a confessor. Confessor means someone who held the faith in a time of persecution. We have had our faith tested by having had to confess it at a time of persecution. That the persecution has effectively been done by people like ourselves, but who are just terrified of being who they are, is a sad reality. But the fact that now increasingly we're able to stand up and say, actually, no, I'm a gay Catholic, and the faith is wonderful. It's true. And Jesus does love us. And the whole point of the sacraments is that they do enable us to do all sorts of things. They do empower us. We are becoming more than we thought we were through this life. I think that that is a wonderful sign of how what seemed to be the margins, in fact, turns out to save the center and rebuild the center.
So we've talked about how there are a lot of closeted gay priests out there and definitely higher up in the clergy of the church as well. If someone says to you, hey, we can't have priests coming out of the closet, like it's nobody's business anyway, what do you say to them?
I would say at the moment it's going to be very difficult for priests to come out of the closet because they will be so frightened of losing their friends, their support, et cetera, depending especially on which diocese they're in. ultimately, it's in everybody's interest that the leadership of our church, as of any institution, be people who are living honest lives. So anybody who is concerned, for instance, about the church's tendency to cover up on the child abuse issue should want honest gay clergy rather than clergy who can be blackmailed into covering up things that are far worse, which is what's been happening so far. I mean, the real problem that we is blackmailability leading to cover up. We don't want to have an institution in which our principal leaders are subject to what I believe the Trump regime now has taught us as being a great Soviet gift of kompromat. We don't want blackmailable leaders. Why should we have? We're supposed to be a church of witnesses. So, obviously, I don't think that anyone can be forced to come out, but I think that church authority has to, over time, make it possible for its own leadership to live honest lives so that they are not blackmailable. We've seen how catastrophic things are when people are frightened that they can be blackmailed into covering up this or that. So no more of that.
We agree. Okay, so the next question. Queer Catholics often feel rather outside the church, and even as they remain faithfully inside, what advice do you have for young queer people of the church that are trying to figure out if they still have any place within?
I mean, they obviously do have a place within. It's the question of what's the place they're going to create for them and people they love. That's all. Don't ask what your church can do for you. Ask what you can do for your church. That's the thing. This is your party. Make it a better party. And I think that increasingly people are saying that. Yeah, I'm not going to be chased out by these people who are playing these closeted games. We're going to try and create intentional spaces where we can share our faith as gay and lesbian people, take part in the ordinary life of the church, and also learn how to be genuinely charitable, how to do great things, how to stand up for those in greater need than ourselves. Because that's what no one can take away from you. No one can take away from you loving the poor, visiting those in prison, helping the sick, etc., etc., protecting migrants from ICE or whatever. No one can take that away from you. So, you know, hypercharged Catholic faggotry surely includes having a certain edge for the marginalized.
what's your favorite part about being a priest, and what's your favorite part about being gay?
Oh, what's my favorite part about being a priest? Actually, I love presiding and preaching, particularly the preaching going with the presiding. I really love sinking into the, as I prepare the gospel, finding what it is that what is it that Jesus wants to make present about himself and his message? What is it he wants to give to people on this particular Sunday? And then attempting to have a place in that, in sharing that. What do I like most about being gay? Gosh, there's so much. I mean, when you're a kid and young, you think of its disadvantages, and now I just think it's such a privilege. Have friends all over the place, amazing sharing network of people, amazing quizzical, slightly odd view of things, you know, because you look at it from different perspectives, but also just the beauty of men. So those are things I enjoy about being gay. What else should I enjoy? I don't know. I'm missing many gay genes. I don't have the interior designer gene. I don't have the Broadway musical gene. I don't have the liturgy gene. I don't have the cooking gene. So,
trust me. I know many gay men that are missing those genes. I think it's a false narrative that we've placed on.
Okay, good. Well, there we are. So yeah, no. I think I hit 60 last week, and it's just such a privilege. Just such a privilege.
Happy birthday.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. To be a gay man at this time, especially when it's possible to be open and honest and not be blackmailed and not frightened of having people hit you the whole time and so on and so forth.
While it's tough being queer in the Catholic Church, being Catholic in the secular world, especially in the gay community, can also be tough. It's often very taboo, shunned, and we're often looked at as an anomaly. What is one sentence that you would say to those in the secular world who aren't approving or are confused as to we as queer individuals stay within the faith?
Get over it, honey.
I mean, that's a good answer. That's a good answer.
Seriously, because they, you know, people feel that they need to have an intellectual reason to dislike the Catholic Church because of all the awful things that it does. And that, they're perfectly right. But it's never the intellectual thing. In every generation, it's the long-term lived testimony of real people who have discovered something true about the way Jesus is amongst us and builds us up and gives himself to us. And that's the kind of thing that we've discovered because it's about love. Like being gay is about love. And those two taken together are life projects. So people can witter on about this or that problem. They like, oh, but the Spanish Inquisition, oh, but blah, 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 blah. Yeah, let them witter on about it. You're involved in a life project. Eventually, if they stick around long enough, they'll see that life projects are actually more worthwhile than they thought and will come to respect you. If all they want is a virtue signaling exercise, well, then let them.
Speaking of life projects and love, we want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. But Pat and I are getting married in February, and so we
wanted how lovely.
We wanted to close by asking you, what advice do you have for us in our marriage?
Oh God, you need to ask someone who can do that. So you need to ask someone who's got genuine experience of that. Always remember a third, a real third in your life, whether a dog, a child, a shared project, something to take you out of the face-to-face. I think that's tremendously important, or something to allow your face-to-face to be mediated. I think that would be true in any loving relationship, isn't it?
That's wonderful. Thank you. And James, once again, thank you so much for taking this time to talk with us. Tell our listeners where they can find your work.
www.jamesallison, that's with one L in Allison and one S in Allison, .co.uk.
So what are we toasting this week, Jacob?
So today, we're recording this on the 16th of October, but it's National Pronouns Day. So toasting to all you trans, non-binary, and genderqueer folk out there living your true lives. And to the babies who are still kind of in the closet, just know that we're out there supporting you. And
if you're not ready to announce your pronouns to the world, that is all right. Exactly. We are here for you.
And to the allies who affirm these trans and queer lives, by using correct pronouns. It's not that hard. Just give it a little try. And, affirming by using pronouns goes a long way.
Absolutely. Well, October is LGBT History Month, so I'm toasting Matthew Reamer and Leighton Brown. Together, they run the Instagram account at @LGBT_history. And it is easily one of my favorite social media accounts and pretty much the only one that I feel like I'm actually learning anything from. They do an incredible job posting photos and accompanying stories, especially stories about the POC leaders that have gotten the queer community this far. So make sure that you go and follow them if you're not already. All right, y'all, that is it for us. You can support the podcast by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts, and you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/vineandfigco. If you like this interview, please consider sharing it with a friend. We think that there are a lot of folks out there who could really benefit from hearing from what Father James Allison said. We are also going to try and record more interviews like this in the future, so if you have any suggestions for who we should talk to, email us at vineandfigco@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Bye. Texted Father James Allison and left him on read.
Like he didn't like the way that description of the phone call went. He was like, bitch, you fucked that up. That is not what I told you.